Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Marco Meglio, editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we sat down with Dr. Nancy Foldberry Schaefer, director of the Sleep Disorder Center at Cleveland Clinic, who shed some insight on several posters presented at the 2025 AAN annual meeting regarding sleep disorders, the crossover between sleep and epilepsy, and the effects of SSRIs on respiratory patterns. Foldberry Schaefer, who's led several different sleep-related trials in her career, spoke on some of the sleep-related topics discussed at the meeting, the clinical utility of Cleveland Clinic's Sleep Mobile app, and the possibility for testing for sleep disorders and sleep architecture in patients with epilepsy as they enter clinical studies. Let's dive into it.
As always, the AAN will ensure that some of the basic kinds of common sleep disorders that all physicians see, regardless of your background specialty, you know, are known about, it specifically in the neurology community. And so there were sessions on obstructive sleep apnea, which of course is the most common sleep disordered breathing. There are sessions on insomnia and parasomnia. I hosted or led a symposium on hypersomnias with my colleague here at Cleveland Clinic, which was very well attended, and it was very exciting because we did the same program 2 years ago, and it was the first time a hypersomnia program, I believe, was accepted. And the room was about maybe a third full, and it's a smaller room, so it wasn't too big of a showing. You know, people stayed, and then we were invited back this last year, and it was standing room only. And these are general neurologists who don't really practice a lot of sleep medicine, like treating narcolepsy and idiopathic hypersomnia, these kinds of things. But clearly there's a lot of advances in that area. And neurologists see these patients, or probably see these patients, and may not recognize it. And it can lead to people being misdiagnosed or not diagnosed. So there's plenty of data that supports that people with narcolepsy and idiopathic hypersomnia, which are two of the primary central nervous system disorders of hypersomnolence, have a delay in diagnosis of at least a decade. And so these are people who generally are becoming symptomatic with excessive sleepiness or excessive need to sleep that affects daytime functioning, probably in their second decade, but not getting recognized until the third or fourth decade, which can have significant implications, you know, on academic, you know, success and employment opportunities, these kinds of things. So they are conditions that are associated with a significant amount of quality of life impairment, yet we're not recognizing them as a sleep community, and even more so probably as a neurology community. So I think that's super important. And I'll just say one more thing before I stop, which is that there is always some discussion at the AAN on REM sleep behavior disorder, and that story is really evolving. So REM behavior disorder is a parasomnia, which means para, around somnia, sleep, around sleep. So around sleep are disorders where people do abnormal behaviors or abnormal movements. And that can be as one is entering sleep, coming out of sleep, or in the middle of sleep. A specific parasomnia, REM sleep behavior disorder, happens specifically in REM sleep. And this disorder is a precursor to the alpha synucleinopathies that include Parkinson's disease, multiple system atrophy, and dementia with Lewy bodies, meaning that almost 95% of people who have REM behavior disorder will be having one of those neurological degenerative diseases within 10, 12, 13 years. And so there's this opportunity that we've recognized for a long time, but is increasingly becoming more understood, this opportunity to identify people at risk for neurodegeneration through a sleep history and through a sleep study, perhaps. And so this is, I think, really important for neurologists to recognize, and certainly puts sleep medicine sort of in that space of helping to prevent deteriorations in brain health.
Yeah, we've definitely seen a lot more research come out, you know, kind of focusing in on the interplay between sleep disorders and some of those neurodegenerative disorders. And I mean, those findings would definitely have a lot of implications considering the fact that we've always tried to get patients in as early as possible for these clinical trials for neurodegenerative diseases. I know now we're trying to get into the prodromal phases and things of that sorts, which is tough, obviously, because we don't really know who has it yet, but still getting better with some of the biomarkers and the assays to actually identify some of those patients. Dr. Fulvery-Schaefer, you know, one of the presentations that you had, or one of the poster presentations, focused in on the Sleep Mobile app. So can you talk a little bit about what the Sleep Mobile app is, how it functions, and just some of the advantages it has for the clinical community?
So Sleep by Cleveland Clinic is a mobile application that we created a few years ago. It was in the iOS store, and then last year got into the Google App Store. So now available on Apple iPhones and Androids. And really, this project came about through a collaboration with a woman who has donated to the Cleveland Clinic Sleep Disorder Center for us to really develop strategies so that everyone can screen themselves for common sleep disorders. And it really came about because our partner's husband died in his sleep, and he's believed to be the first person in the U.S. who has cause of death on his death certificate of sleep apnea, which is not typical. Untreated sleep apnea certainly can be part of a progression of chronic disease. That can escalate cardiovascular disease and metabolic disorders, et cetera. But this was a rather unique situation. And she partnered with us specifically so that we could help develop mechanisms for people to train themselves, recognizing that still in some parts of the country, it takes a long time to get in for a sleep study. And you may talk to your primary care doctor or your primary care, you know, healthcare provider, but forget to mention about snoring or sleep apnea, or just not talk about your sleep, or maybe have that provider not recognize that you might be at risk of sleep apnea, because rural medical providers don't really get a lot of sleep training. So for all these limitations, we estimate that a significant number of people have common sleep disorders that are not diagnosed and not treated. And so Sleep by Cleveland Clinic is completely you know, an automated mobile application where there are four screening instruments for the four most common sleep disorders. So we consider those obstructive sleep apnea. And the instrument that is used is one that we created at the Cleveland Clinic and validated, which has a little bit more an advantage over some of the existing screening tools like the STOP and the STOP-Bang, in that we use age and BMI as continuous variables. So we can provide a probability score of having sleep apnea rather than just your high risk or you're not high risk. We use the insomnia severity scale, which is a validated insomnia tool. We created a way to calculate 24-hour sleep duration, so we can estimate if somebody has insufficient sleep or maybe is an oversleeper. And oversleep is also associated with some comorbidities. And then finally, we received copyright permission to use a shift work disorder instrument that's in the literature, because we know that people with shift work problems or shift workers are at increased risk for medical disorders by virtue of having poor sleep because of their shift work. So these are for adults. This app is for adults. And so anyone screening could take one of those or could take all four of those instruments and immediately see some scores that would tell you, are you in the, you know, red zone? Are you in the green zone? Where are you in this? And then it takes you to next steps where you can do some easy reading on your mobile device. And then, of course, it takes you to getting help, which is where you can enter your zip code and it will take you to the nearest board certified sleep program physician or accredited sleep center in the country. So not just necessarily driving people to Cleveland, Ohio, but to anywhere that's the closest for them to get care. And so this was a couple of years of a project where we're really happy to be launching it all now. And we actually started a healthy sleep program for the Cleveland area firefighters. And so they're using the mobile application as our sort of first pilot group. But it's free. and it gives you immediate results. And the next step that we're working on, which is almost there for Cleveland Clinic patients, is that those scores will dump into your medical record, and they could be accessible to the next physician you see in our system, so that there's a connectivity there. It's in your medical record, so a physician can act on those results.
So one other sort of analysis that you presented was on the characteristics associated with obstructive sleep apnea in adults with epilepsy. And I know you've obviously done a lot of research yourself, focusing on both the sleep side of things as well as patients with epilepsy. So provide a little bit more insight on that analysis and what those findings revealed specifically.
I must say that epilepsy, and I also practice epilepsy medicine. So epilepsy is one of those neurological conditions that's been probably better studied in terms of its relationships with sleep than most others. We've been investigating this in the epilepsy community for over 100 years. We know basic things like that sleep deprivation can trigger seizures, and that certain types of epilepsies are characterized by certain types of sleep patterns. So these things have been recognized for a long time. Going back to about 2012, we published the largest series of adults with epilepsy undergoing in-laboratory sleep studies who were not referred to the lab. There are many, many reports describe patients who are referred to the lab, but most people referred to a sleep lab for a test have sleep apnea, and that's why they were referred. And so there's referral bias there. So we recruited over 130 patients who did not have, or whose sleep history the investigators were unaware of at the time that they were tested, and found that over 40% of them had obstructive sleep apnea, and 16% of them had moderate to severe sleep apnea. And moderate to severe sleep apnea was defined as having at least 15 times per hour of a respiratory event that would lead to either an arousal or an oxygen desaturation. And we know that people with moderate to severe sleep apnea are at increased risk for cardiovascular disease. We now know dementia, metabolic disorders like obesity and diabetes. So those were the patients that are really the most in need of treatment. And so we've recognized for some time that obstructive sleep apnea is something that is highly prevalent in adults with epilepsy. And anecdotally, you know, I've seen many patients who were younger, thinner, not big with neck size, maybe not loud snorers, who still had obstructive sleep apnea. And we had done a little investigation in this in the past, but this particular analysis was to look at the traditional factors that drive obstructive sleep apnea in the general population and just see if they're the same ones that drive obstructive sleep apnea in adults with epilepsy, as well as to study whether it's the epilepsy or the treatment of the epilepsy that may be independently driving this higher prevalence of obstructive sleep apnea. So we found that some of the typical culprits, you know, male gender, obesity, age, advancing age, were all associated with a higher risk of obstructive sleep apnea, which makes sense because adults with epilepsy should have some of the same factors driving sleep apnea as the general population. We found that one important question that we ask in the sleep clinic all the time, which is, are you sleepy? Are you tired? Which is in the instruments that are validated that are used for obstructive sleep apnea, did not associate with obstructive sleep apnea in this population, which also makes a lot of sense because people with epilepsy always say they're tired. Very few of them will say, I'm not tired or sleepy, because the condition of epilepsy is associated with so much dysfunction of sleep and daytime impairment of daytime functioning that symptom is commonly there. But I think most importantly, what we found was that the severity of seizures, the frequency of seizures, the burden of anti-seizure medication, these things that many think drive obstructive sleep apnea were not associated with a diagnosis of sleep apnea. So that tells me something that is a bit different than what some other investigators have reported, which is that it's not just refractory patients who are having high seizure burden who we should be looking at doing sleep studies on. It's all adults with epilepsy. It's not about their epilepsy severity. You may have a seizure a year or a seizure a day, and those groups are probably not different in terms of their risk. We should be thinking broadly to screen patients with epilepsy for obstructive sleep apnea, since it's easy to screen for and easy to treat. And we also know from our own lab, as well as others, that treatment of that sleep apnea can reduce seizures and improve quality of life in people with epilepsy. So I view sleep treatments around sleep apnea as another way, just an adjunctive therapy that we could be offering patients with epilepsy.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Foldberry Schaefer to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, on April 10th, the FDA approved a pre-filled syringe administration route for efgartigimod, a marketed treatment for generalized myasthenia gravis and chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy. With the decision, it allows patients greater convenience and flexibility, allowing in-home administration and reducing the amount of trips that come with intravenous infusions. Days later, the agency approved Click Therapeutics CT132 as the first digital therapeutic for the preventive treatment of episodic migraine in adults. Approved through the De Novo pathway, the therapy is indicated for patients aged 18 years and older, intended for adjunctive use alongside acute and or other preventive treatments for migraine. Lastly, a day later on April 16th, the FDA approved an expanded indication for diazepam nasal spray for the treatment of acute repetitive seizures in children ages 2 to 5 years old. Previously approved for patients age 6 and older, the update broadens access to an important rescue therapy for younger children experiencing recurrent seizures. For more information about these stories, head to neurologylive.com, where you can check out the corresponding link in the show notes. And now, back to our conversation with Dr. Foldberry Schaefer.
We talk all the time about innovation and clinical trials, and obviously there's a lot of therapeutics currently in development for both sleep disorders as well as patients with epilepsy. So I'm curious, for patients with epilepsy, do you feel as though that screening for sleep disorders and screening for things like obstructive sleep apnea should be something that is required across all clinical trials when trying to enroll patients? Is that also something that is feasible as well to that same point?
Yeah, I think you've been reading my mind. For so long, it seems, you know, there's so many things that we screen for in clinical trials in the anti-seizure medication world, but sleep disorders is really not one of them. And one of the studies we're doing now with one of my research fellows is we're going to compare the performance characteristics of a number of sleep apnea instruments and maybe even create one specific for adults with epilepsy that has even higher performance characteristics than the usual ones we see in the literature. Because it should be that we should be recognizing patients who are very short sleepers, which, you know, insomnia and short sleep usually doesn't exclude someone from a clinical trial. But we're not at all looking at sleep apnea, and maybe the comorbidity of having high risk sleep apnea would lead to a difference in outcomes in a number of ways in clinical trials. So I think that is an area that is not thoroughly evaluated for. And yet these disorders are as common as depression. And we certainly are very, very aggressive at understanding depression in this population. And the sleep disorder is sort of interrelated with depression, which is very important due to obviously the risk of suicidality associated with medications and just the high comorbidity of psychiatric conditions anyway. So all of these things are intertwined. And I think 100% we should be thinking of ways to include a little bit of a sleep assessment in all these pharmacotherapy trials in epilepsy.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Just, you know, the reason why I kind of bring that up is obviously for some of the neurodegenerative disorders, there are this study specifically, the inclusion and exclusion criteria for those is insanely, insanely detailed these days, and oftentimes kind of even leaving out what the real world population is. And you obviously see sometimes where some of the neuropsychiatric symptoms of patients, those patients are not eligible to be in some of these trials and things of that sort. So it would be interesting to see if that adds a different element to the clinical studies, whether we see a difference in outcomes based on patient sleep patterns and things of that sorts. But yeah, I mean, obviously, like you mentioned, it does play a role into these patients, and it does play a factor into how their prognosis is long term, to say the least. Dr. Foldberry Schaefer, I have one last question for you, touching on one last study that you presented at AAN, which was focusing in on the relationship between SSRI use and respiratory changes with patients with epilepsy. So provide a little bit of comment on that study specifically, as well as just some of the significance of those findings.
So this was very much an exploratory analysis around a larger data set that we've collected. And what we've done over several years now is, when feasible, collected respiratory variables. So this is airflow and effort, like you would record in a sleep study to measure breathing patterns, carbon dioxide of various types, oxygen saturation, surrounding seizures when people are inside the epilepsy monitoring unit, and specifically having stereo EEG. So this is an invasive form of implantation. And these specific cases are targeting autonomic systems within the brain, largely because the semiology or the behaviors associated with these seizures prompted investigation into these specific nodes in the brain. And so we're collecting respiratory data surrounding these seizures to better understand if there are types of epilepsies that invade or involve a certain part of the brain that leads to an apnea or leads to somebody not being able to fully breathe off their CO2. And as a result, might be posing a risk even of death surrounding a seizure, sudden unexplained death in epilepsy. So we're investigating these respiratory variables to better understand if there's a respiratory component that's induced by seizures that may play into SUDEP. And there have been a couple of prior investigations around the use of SSRIs, you know, common antidepressants used in people with epilepsy because of the potential for respiratory support related to serotonin, basically. In sleep apnea world, years ago, we would sometimes use SSRI medications to increase serotonin, believing that it promoted upper airway tone and might make the airway less collapsible. And so we wanted to investigate what the difference in these periictal patterns might be in people using SSRIs versus not using SSRIs. And we didn't find many differences, but we found a few key things. One was that patients using SSRIs had higher respiratory rate, but they also had lower end-tidal CO2 values. So that might suggest that the SSRI has some effect on increasing respiratory sensitivity, which may be part of a protective mechanism in SUDEP. This was very exploratory. There are basic science labs around the world investigating this, but we're taking the opportunity to do these kinds of investigations because the Cleveland Clinic has a very large and very reputable and advanced invasive EEG program. And because we have so many patients undergoing stereo EEG, and we have the ability, therefore, to sort of pull in these respiratory variables that normally would be only part of a sleep study, but we're able to pull some of them in, at least in some of these patients, to combine with their EEG to see what the bigger picture is. And so this was just one small part of that sort of journey of investigation.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.